Good morning.
Good morning, George. How are you? Happy Columbus Day.
Thank you, Ron. This is George Ristoff from Weikert Realtors All Pro. We're doing our Columbus Day morning podcast for Hour 91, our informative session that talks about current real estate events. And our guest today is Ron Riccio from Chicagoland Home Mortgage Services. And Ron has joined us in the past, and we're going to be continuing with some information on the lending game in the Chicago market, national impressions, national impacts that are going on, and just things that we find that are most topical, and a lot of the requests that we get from our buyers and future borrowers that Ron will be able to elaborate on as we move forward today. Now, Ron, in the past, we've talked about a few different things. Why don't we give just a little recap of a couple of the things that we've discussed over the last few podcasts?
So I know over the last few podcasts, we've talked about down payment, minimum down payments, 3% down conventional, 3.5% down FHA. We've also talked about closing costs and how much those typically run, which is around $6,000 for a typical purchase. That can vary depending upon if you have transfer taxes for various municipalities. And then we've also talked about how those can be paid, that the seller can actually pay those costs if they're negotiated into the contract, or the lender can pick up a portion or all of those costs by a borrower taking a slightly higher interest rate to be able to not to have to pay those costs. So those are the few things, few of the things that we've run across in the past.
Good. Well, one of the things that we always start with as realtors, when we meet a new client or one of our associates in the office meets a new client, our office policy and best practices would be that we would want to find out the level of qualification for that buyer before we would start the process of looking for homes. And that has some practical implications. First, we want to make sure that we don't go down the road with a buyer, have their expectations raised to an unreasonable level, and also from the perspective of eventually negotiating a contract on their behalf, if we represent the buyer, we want to know that they are going to be good to go when they have the financing contingency, which is typically 30 to 40 days for them to get the loan. So we want to make sure that that's all going to work out well in the client's behalf. And when I started in the business many years ago, the realtors had varying levels of interest and also varying levels of where it was their obligation basically to kind of perform these services themselves. And as the marketplace has changed over the last 20 to 30 years, then lenders have become directly involved very early in the process. So let's talk a little bit about when that first time buyer walks in the door and they come to us, and then we say, well, where are you at on getting a loan? And oftentimes they say they do not have someone that they're working with yet, and then we make the phone call over to you, Ron, and then you take it from there.
Well, what we do at that point, George, is we begin the pre-qualification process. And a few of the things I want to touch upon this morning is qualifying somebody and what are their qualifying ratios, what is their qualifying income, and also what is their qualifying time on the job or their employment. So I started in the business back in 1991, 28 years ago, and when I first started, the qualifying ratios back then were 28-36. And what that meant was, or what that means, is that 28% of your gross monthly income, not your net, your gross, could be your mortgage payment, and 36% of your gross monthly income could be your total payment. So your total mortgage payment, which what I mean by total mortgage payment includes your monthly amount for taxes, for homeowners insurance, if you have PMI, as well as the principal and interest. And again, the 36% would be your total mortgage payment along with any car payments, any installment loans, any other types of student debt or anything like that. It does not include any utilities, it does not include any tuition or anything like that because those are voluntary items. So back then, 28-36, so if you have a $10,000 a month gross income, $120,000 a year, you're looking at a maximum mortgage payment of $2,800 and total payments of $3,600 per per year. So that's now somewhat changed. It had gotten as high as 65% of your gross monthly income.
Wow. Okay.
Right before the housing crisis in 2007, we had gotten as high as 65%, which part of that attributed to the problem that we had in the housing crisis, because lenders, Fannie and Freddie, had gotten really aggressive in terms of what they allowed for people to do. And now it's been scaled back to around 45%. So we still look at two ratios, but it's more so one ratio now. So typically 45% for a conventional loan. They'll let you go up in certain cases up to 49.9%. And then on the FHA side, they allow you to get a little bit more aggressive. So if your credit scores are high, if you've got some good compensating factors where you've got some extra reserves or whatnot, they'll let you go as high as 55% on the FHA side. So the FHA, again, standing for Federal Housing Authority.
So that's pretty aggressive, excuse me, in the marketplace. The totals, I think, are going to obviously vary based on what an individual's personal affordability factor is as to what their budget is on a monthly basis, and they're going to have to look at that very critically when they get started with the process, just to make sure that they're not in a position where they're reaching outside their comfort levels to be able to make that happen. That being said, of course, making a purchase of your first home, I think almost all buyers universally feel that they're outside of their comfort levels, in usually coming from family property, possibly moving out from mom and dad, or they've been in a rental apartment. And even though the rents are going up in our marketplace, usually there is a jump from where they start out on the rental basis to where they wind up on a first-time purchase.
That's correct. That's correct. You touched upon a good point here, George, that I think that the current ratios that are available right now for lending, I think that those are fine. I think that they're even somewhat aggressive in some cases. And we often tell customers, we say, you know, again, we can probably approve you for more than what you're comfortable with. Ultimately, you want to be comfortable with that payment moving forward. So I wanted to talk a little bit this morning, too, not only about the qualifying ratios, but what type of income do we look at and how do we use that income in order to qualify to arrive to our qualifying ratios? So if you have someone who's a W-2 employee, somebody who works for someone else, we basically can take what their annual salary is and we basically divide that by 12, and that's their gross monthly income that we use. Or if somebody's an hourly employee, we take their hourly rate by their minimum number of hours per week, which is typically between 36 and 40. And we typically take that gross number divide and multiply that by 52 weeks to get our annual. And then we divide that by 12. And that's our monthly W-2, or a monthly, excuse me, a salary, or our monthly hourly amount that we use. If someone has been with their company for 2 years or more, we can also take a two-year average of their overtime, their bonuses, or their commissions, if they receive any and all of those three, as long as those averages are going up. So that is typically verified through the employer. We send out a verification of employment. It's a document that the employer fills out that breaks down their income over the last 2 years, and we'll use that. So if we have somebody that wants to use that income in order to qualify for something a little bit more, we can definitely take that into consideration.
Okay, good. The excuse me, the scenarios of first time buyers coming from either a position where they're coming from school environment, or they're coming from an environment where they're in an acceleration mode for their salaries. They've had a first-time job, and now they've moved up and improved their position, and now they have a second-level position. How does that impact their ability to go get financing when it seems like they're on the move up, but it's not verifiable necessarily for those two-year time frames?
So the great thing about being a W-2 employee is that as soon as you get a raise, we can immediately use that new income to help you qualify. So if you go from a $50,000 salary per year, and all of a sudden your salary jumps up to 100, we can immediately use that $100,000 salary to help you qualify. So there's no waiting period. The only time that you have basically a waiting period in some cases is if you're self-employed. So self-employed people, unlike W-2 employees, we have to show a two-year average. So because that is not consistent income, we look at the last 2 years of completed tax returns and take a two-year average of what your income is, as long as that average is going up. If it's going down, then we'll take the lower of the two. An underwriter is going to be conservative. Fannie and Freddie have also stated that we need to be conservative in taking the lower of the two and basically using that 1 year, dividing that by 12 as the gross monthly income. But if you're W-2'd and your actual base salary goes up, we can immediately use what that new base salary is going to be to help you qualify for a higher amount.
Okay, that's good. Good to hear. The scenarios that that we see in the marketplace are varied. So you have basic guidelines and underwriting rules that you need to follow. You're not ad-libbing these things, Ron?
No, these are basic. These are underwriting guidelines that are coming to us directly from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as FHA. So that is all given to us, and so we basically all have the same rules that we have to play by. If we have certain portfolio products that may have different rules, some different guidelines, those are going to come with some very different interest rates, some higher rates, some different types of programs. But for the most part, if it's Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or FHA, that's all going to be the same for all of us.
Okay, so let's put out the scenario. It's tough to make it in America with one job. We are seeing many, many individuals approaching their income challenges with looking at picking up supplemental income. So let's put out the scenario that someone has a typical W-2 position. And then they do get some reliable income coming in on that W-2. But in addition to that, they pick up another job along the way, something that would be self-employment income, could be anything from being an Uber driver to having a real estate license, let's say. And there's income that comes in, but it's not guaranteed income. It varies. So how does that play into the process? Is there a combination formula that works for those individuals, or how does that work?
We do. So we actually have to use a two-year average. If somebody has, let's say, either part-time work, let's say it's even a part-time job that somebody's gotten in addition to their current W-2 full-time employment. Even if it's a W-2 job, we have to have 2 years of part-time supplemental income before we can use that. If it is Schedule C, if it's self-employment, if it's a sole proprietor income, such as a real estate agent who's going to be deemed a 1099 employee, so if it's a real estate agent or an Uber driver, anybody picking up additional income, we have to have a two-year average that shows up on the tax returns in order to use that income in addition to their W-2 income.
Okay. So otherwise, they're just locked in until they put those 2 years in. And of course, those are going to vary. Typically, as you're getting into a part-time, you're going to have a ramp up in year two. So then you get more into an averaging scenario for years one and two. When they hit the two-year deadline.
That's correct. So after the 2 years, after we can show that we have either 2 years of W-2s or 2 years of tax returns showing that they've had this additional income, we can take that two-year average and add it to their regular W-2 income in order for us to be able to use that to qualify for more.
Okay, that's great. That's great. The interest rate climate that we're dealing with right now is a climate where we've had a couple of increases this year already in 2018, and it's on the books for stated policy from the government side that it looks like there's future increases that are going to be in the offing too. So many individuals, given that scenario, may opt to look at a situation where they have a variable interest rate on it rather than have the fixed rate loan. And Could you talk a little bit about the pros and cons of that scenario?
Sure. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we just had the government's employment report that came out on Friday. So the first Friday of every month is when we get the jobs report from the government. And it came in at 3.7%, which was the lowest in 49 years. So it was the lowest unemployment level that we had seen since 1969. The wage inflation component of that report was still above the Fed's target rate. It was down just slightly from 2.9 the previous month to 2.8. The Fed has raised two times this year. They're going to raise again. It looks like they're going to raise rates again in December. And what the Fed raises is not specifically mortgage rates. They raise a short-term rate called the Fed funds rate, and then that in turn banks will raise their prime rate by the same amount, and that filters down into commercial rates. It can go into auto loans and credit cards and whatnot, and into home equity lines, but not directly into mortgage rates. Mortgage rates will move depending upon what's happening with economic reports. But what's happened is that since last week, we actually touched upon and just hit 5% on the 30-year fixed, which is the highest rate that we've seen in the last 7 years. So the good thing about that is that, you know, there was a recent survey out stating that 90% of the people that are looking for real estate right now would still continue to look even if rates breached 5%, which is good because it still shows that it's a very bullish market. What we may start seeing now is we may start seeing more adjustable rates being used for people instead of the fixed rate. So if fixed rates jump above 5% and we still have adjustable rate mortgages that are, let's say, in the fours, we may actually get people that want to use those products instead of a 30-year fixed. And typically the way that they work is that they're spread over 30 years, like a 30-year fixed rate, but a 5-1 ARM or a 7-1 ARM just basically means that either for 5 or 7 years, the rate is fixed and then will turn into a 1-year adjustable after that every year until the loan is paid off. So if you have a 5-year, 5-1 ARM, rate is fixed for the first 5 years, and then in year 6, it'll turn into a 1-year adjustable, and then will adjust once every year until the mortgage is paid off or refinanced. Most times people don't stay in an adjustable rate for a long period of time. They'll use it more so as a stepping stone until rates maybe come back down or until they move into their next property. So usually those are paid off early. They may have an adjustment. They may have one or two adjustments, and then they're moving on to their next mortgage or their next place.
Okay. That's good to know. And if someone's looking at really a short-term plan and expects to be in a home for anywhere from, say, 3 years to 5 years, then the adjustable rate mortgage might be a good solution potentially for them.
Yes. I mean, I think adjustable rates are great if they're used, especially in a scenario like you just mentioned, somebody's a first-time home buyer, and let's say they're going to be buying into a property that they know they're only going to be there for maybe 3 or 5 years. They may want to use a 5 or 7 year adjustable to get a lower interest rate, knowing that they're not going to have the risk of having to see if that rate's going to adjust very high, that they're most likely going to sell and pay that mortgage off even prior to that first adjustment happening.
Good news. The 30-year program, which has always been the bread and butter of our business, provides a certain assurance that no matter what happens out there for the next 30 years, you know what your fixed P&I is going to be. So almost across the board, we like to take a look at that for our borrowers when they get started, because it's the safest and it's the most conservative scenario. I personally, on the adjustable rate program, I think that if you have individuals that are a little bit more affluent and they have more opportunities to buffer a future increase in the, that could come from an adjustable rate mortgage, they might be in a little bit better position to do that. If you have someone that's just kind of squeaking by to get that first purchase, 5 years goes very quickly in our industry, and we never want someone to be in a position where they don't feel comfortable with the outcome of the rates. We've been living in a low interest rate marketplace, but you and I have been in the marketplace when rates have been higher. I remember my own first purchase of a home, and we were in the teens on the interest rate. So that's over 10, and it was considerably over 10 when I made my first purchase. So this phenomenon that we've had may be something that's not that familiar to individuals that have just been in the marketplace for the last 5 to 10 years there. So historically, maybe you could comment on where interest rates are, even using the 5% level from the time that you've been in the business, Ron.
So when I first started out in 1991, my first mortgage that I did was at 9 7/8, so just below 10%. And then from that point, we saw rates begin to come down when we actually saw rates in 90, sometime later in 91, come down around 8.5, and we had a refi boom. And from there, I think our next level down from 8.5, we went down to 7, and then from 7, we broke below 6. And during each one of those times, we had a run of people wanting to refinance their interest rates all the way, fast forwarding all the way down to about 2012, where we hit 3.25 on a 30-year fixed. So we haven't seen a lot of adjustable rates here in the past 7 years, just because fixed mortgages have been so low. And the yield curve has been so flat, so there wasn't really that huge benefit to going with adjustable. And, you bring up a good point. Even with my customers, I'm very conservative. I always like to offer the fixed rate first, just because you never know if something changes in somebody's life to where they decide not to move, or let's say there's a job loss, or let's say somebody decides to stop working and they decide to stay in that property longer. You're not going to have to worry about an increase on the interest rate. And even if they decide to move, in some cases, I've had clients that have taken the fixed rate, bought their first property, and decided to keep that property as an investment, as a rental investment, and then they've moved up and they bought something, they've saved up money, and they used their own money to buy their next property, to use that money as their own money as a down payment, and they've kept that first property as an investment, having that low fixed 30-year, that's worked out great for them. And for people that, if they would have taken an adjustable rate, that wouldn't have been the case. They would have either had to have refinanced that property into probably a higher interest rate, or they would have had to have sold that property or sell that property in order to get those proceeds out, because that rate then would have been variable on a year-to-year basis, which can be scary.
All right. Well, I think the key thing that we look at now is, and we've gone through this in the marketplace a few times over the years, is the prospect of what's going to go on with price as interest rates go up. And I guess from a first-time buyer perspective, one of the challenges is if you have a combination of rising prices and then also rising interest rates, which has happened several times over the last maybe 30 to 40 years historically. It's not a common occurrence because typically as rates go up, then there's usually a little bit of a cooling in the real estate marketplace, but a lot of it again goes back to demand and the supplies that are out there in the overall marketplace. So those are the factors that we're always looking at. And no one has the complete answer as to what's coming down the pike in the next few months, or what's going to be happening in 2019. But savvy buyers that are out there should get the input of their realtor, their financial consultant, their family members. Just good common sense it really comes into play, I think, in trying to make that decision as to what's a good time for them to potentially be looking at buying their first home, or actually moving up, which has its own individual challenges on the buy-up side, because now you have to handle two transactions at the same time, making sure that we link up the timing of the sale of their first property and then also their acquisition of their second property. So again, that's a little tricky out there. I'm sure you've got a few of those that are going in the marketplace right now, Ron.
It is. I think we're experiencing a bit of that squeeze that you had talked about right now. So I think we're seeing home prices on a national average rising between somewhere between 5.5% and 6%, in some cases, in some areas higher. And now we're seeing mortgage rates go up. And the wage inflation, again, I go back to that wage inflation component of the jobs report. Wage inflation is not moving up as fast to keep in pace with that, in line with that, because typically home prices and wages are supposed to rise at the same level. So when home prices rise faster than wages, typically lower interest rates are subsidizing that and helping to prop that up. So now we're actually seeing rates going up. We're seeing home prices going up. So I think one or two things is going to happen. Either home prices are going to begin to cool as rates continue to go, if rates continue to go up, or I think we may actually see rates at some point come down, maybe later on in 2019. It's difficult to say. The economy is doing very well. The economy is very strong right now. So depending upon how long that continues and how long the equities continue to do well, I think is all going to kind of depend upon what's going to happen here with the real estate market.
Okay. In kind of a closeout and a final summary here, could you comment on the national perspective of funding on the money? Where's the money coming in for these loans? And then how that might have an impact. I have my own personal thoughts on our local market here in the state of Illinois. So what's your feel on how these national pressures affect things going on locally?
Well, I think in terms of what's happening nationally, and I think you're even locally, I mean, you've got different pockets of the city that are continuing to do well. And then you've got different pockets of the suburbs that are continuing to do well. But I really think it goes down, it really comes back down to inventory and where you're at in terms of where you're buying, if that's going to continue to go up. But again, I think you were asking the question about how some of these are funded. Is that how you were,
well,
kind of, or where
I know
money's coming up?
Yeah, it's not necessarily always a local feel. It's not just local money that sees and looks at local pricing. I'm seeing more of the impact of, let's say, that the economy and housing market on a nationwide basis. There are many areas that are very hot now and are outpacing perhaps what we're doing locally.
Yes.
And that puts the pricing for those dollars, I'm assuming, at a certain level. And that does not always fall in sync exactly with your local market, be it Chicago, Cook County, or any of the six counties in the marketplace that we deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah, so I think there's different pockets of the country. If we look at Texas, or if you look at Texas or Florida or California, there's certain areas there that the market's still moving very fast. But then there's other markets in the country that are offsetting that. So I think here right now in the Chicago market, we are now experiencing, at least from what I can hear from other professionals like yourself, that it has slowed a little bit. It went from a seller's market, and now it's more kind of turning into more a bit of a buyer's market. And as I think, you know, we're going into a time of year where typically there's a little bit of a breather that people are taking here moving forward as we're going into the holidays. I can't believe I'm saying that, but I guess we are going into the holidays here. So those national averages, I think are pretty consistent. Maybe not so much consistent with what we're looking at exactly here in our local market, but I think those national averages are a pretty good indicator of, you know, what's happening right now and what we need to be in tune for here coming up in the future. So I think in 2019 it'll be an interesting year as to how things unfold. I think we're going to have a strong market in the spring for buyers and for rates. I think rates are going to stay relatively low. They may stay here in the low fives for a 30-year fix. They may dip back below 5%, which I think will be, you know, something in the fours. I think is going to be a very vibrant marketplace for new buyers coming into the springtime. And I think beyond that, it's kind of cloudy. It's kind of cloudy to see how things are going to go. I think a lot of it's going to depend on the economy and seeing where wages are going here and whatnot. So,
yep. Well, the future forecasts certainly keep our lives interesting, let's call it that. And we always have to monitor what's going on, both with our local marketplace and also each market is so separate. And there's so many neighborhoods in the city of Chicago and so many local suburban communities and so many price levels in each one of those areas that there is no specific generalization, I think, that covers it all. But that's why having a local realtor to assist you that really understands the marketplace, again, not so much just in a specific neighborhood, but also has maybe a little bit more of an understanding of the economics that are going on within the entire region. I think that that's going to be a benefit for the consumer, for future buyers. So make sure that you're consulting with your neighborhood professional, and hopefully that individual is going to provide you with some great information. So final comment, Ron, for today?
Well, happy Columbus Day to everyone. I think right now, moving forward, I am telling my clients to definitely to jump in the market now. If they're looking at jumping in, I think it's a great time to be buying right now, because if we're in a rising interest rate market, if rates continue to rise, we want you to be at a price point where your payment is going to be relatively reasonable, because if rates move up 0.5% or 1%, depending upon your loan amount, that could be $75 to $150 a month jump. And worst case scenario, if you buy now and rates, which is unlikely, are going to drop later on, you can always look to refinance. But we want to get into a good rate right now where prices are still relatively cheap. I think next year rates are going to be higher, prices are going to be higher. So if you're looking to buy, give us a call and we can work out some numbers to see if it's a viable option for you right now.
That's great. Great common sense stuff there, Ron. And we appreciate your info today. We know that the next couple of months coming up, October, November, and December, certainly have seasonality factors in our Chicago marketplace. So perhaps a first-time buyer can take advantage of that, where there's possibly some homes that are out there, nice homes that just haven't sold, as the market's been a little bit slower over the last month or so. And there could be great opportunities for them to get in the market. And as you commented on, still secure a fixed rate and be under the fives and be in a position that they can lock in and not have to deal with the unknowns for 2019. So that's our wrap-up for today. Thanks again for joining us on Hour 91 for our podcast. Again, host here, George Ristoff from Weikert Realtors All Pro. And our guest today was Ron Riccio from Chicagoland Home Mortgage Services. Thanks again.
Thanks, George. Day.